This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. There is still a great deal we don't know about Iraq's election yesterday. Turnout numbers are thus far just estimates. We won't get even preliminary results until Wednesday. We don't know how many Sunnis participated, though anecdotal evidence suggests the number may have been low. If insurgents failed to prevent the vote, it was not for lack of trying. Dozens of Iraqis died as they tried to vote yesterday. Iraqi and coalition security forces reported over 200 assaults, one of the largest totals for a single day since U.S.-led troops invaded Iraq almost 2 years ago. We know the election itself was far from perfect, and while we don't have the exact number or the percentage yet, we do know that millions of Iraqis defied threats and violence to stand online and cast their ballots. Today, we'll go around that country to get a better idea about how the election went yesterday and gauge reaction today. And we want to hear from you. After yesterday's votes, are you more optimistic? Does the election change how you feel about the U.S. role in Iraq? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin in Baghdad with Carl Vick, the Baghdad Bureau Chief of the Washington Post. Nice to have you back on the program.
Hi, welcome. Nice to be back.
Okay. What's the mood there in Baghdad like today?
You know, it feels like the day after election. It feels like the day after a holiday, after a big event. There was still a curfew in effect until noon here, so we didn't see a lot of cars on the streets. But at noon, cars started coming back. People started moving around again. You know, definitely yesterday felt like a special day, and today, you know, it felt like the day after a special day. A little bit of a sense of letdown, but I don't think, you know, anything like it was before.
Yesterday, as you mentioned, no cars were driving around because there was a ban on them for fear of car bombs. Security was tight all over. How about, again, what's the comparison with today?
Security was still tight again this morning, but I mean, yesterday you were getting checked every couple of blocks, either by if you happened to be out in a car that thought it could move around like reporters tried to. Today, you know, I was able to move across town from where I stayed to the convention center pretty quickly with really only a couple of challenges. So it was slackening down. The whole idea of security today was that they wanted to secure that they were moving some ballots, and they wanted to let this sort of election infrastructure, the mechanics of the election, go forward without being ambushed or vulnerable to attack. Mm.
Your piece in this morning's edition of the Washington Post tells the story of a suicide bomber at a polling station at a girls' high school in Baghdad. Tell us what happened there. You talked to people who were standing online when it happened.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was late morning at this polling station in a relatively sort of upper middle class professional neighborhood in eastern Baghdad. People were coming out to vote there, and they were you get a pat down, you get frisked before you go into the polling station, and it was a suicide bomber. He was wearing an exploding belt or vest, and he had his hands in his pockets, and when the police officer told him to take his hands out of his pockets, he spread them wide, which I think was the triggering device, and blew himself up in the guard and three other people as well. It was a horrible scene, and of course closed down the polling station, but it didn't stay closed. People refused to go home. They waited for the polling station to open again, and many more people were coming to vote after this incident, which, of course, was meant to scare people away from the polls and who had come before. And the people who did come said they were coming to take their country back, to show they weren't going to be intimidated anymore, and that they wanted stability, and they thought stability would come with a government that they elected.
We're talking with Carl Vick of the Washington Post. If you'd like to join the conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. And we have a call from Catherine, who's on the line with us from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Yes, I was calling about the possibility, were people going to be sorted out by assassinations because they have the marks on their fingers, the ink?
The indelible
yes.
Indelible dye, the purple dye on their fingers. Did you hear the question, Carl?
And also...
Yeah, I did. Yeah, go ahead.
And also, I wanted to point out that, you know, we are hailing the bravery of the people who, against all the odds and all the assassination attempts and everything, and the bravery that they had in voting, that we might point out that the Negroes here in America, under great odds with all kinds of intimidation and fire hoses and murder and everything for years, fought also with brave hearts to have their own rights here in America.
Good point, Catherine. On the first question, though, Carl?
Mm-hmm.
That was a real concern beforehand, that people whose lives were being threatened, that is, the insurgents said, if you voted, we'll track you down and kill you, that, you know, they're going to have this ink on their fingers that indicates to poll workers that they voted so they can't vote a second time. And would this, you know, be somehow a death sentence to them? It was a concern before. It hasn't been since. Basically, when people did vote, it was sort of in surges. There was a contagion effect here. It was a matter of people seeing some people. Voting was very light in a lot of places in the morning, maybe because it was a holiday here, and so people slept in. Maybe because the insurgents, the terrorists tend to strike early in the morning, and everyone sort of expected the attacks. And sure enough, Baghdad at about 10 in the morning sounded like a war zone. I mean, it really was. The 260 attacks across the country yesterday were more by far than any other day since the fall of Baghdad. But when that was over, some people stayed through it, and people started coming, and then people started seeing them coming, and because there weren't cars on the roads, they were seeing their neighbors walking down the street. They were watching Arab language television, which wasn't covering the violence nearly as heavily as they were covering the fact of the vote. A vote in the Middle East, a free vote in the Arab world is an unusual thing, and whereas these car bombs and all the rest and these attacks are not. So they understood that there was a surge here, and it grew. As I say, it was this contagion effect. So everybody sort of like had the permission of their neighbors, and it became something that people did together. And people who said they'd talked before about how they weren't going to vote, then saw each other going and all went together.
Catherine, thanks very much for the call.
You're quite welcome.
And Carl Vick, thank you for your time today, as always.
My pleasure.
Carl Vick is Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Spoke and joined us from Baghdad. Returning to this country, a lot Iraqis living in the United States were able to vote. The U.S. was one of 14 countries where voting places were set up for Iraqis who live in exile. Joining us now to talk about the election in his community is Imam Sayed Mustafa Al-Kazwini, imam at the Islamic Education Center of Orange County, California, with us from his home in Los Angeles. And Imam, good of you to join us again.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Neil.
You were at the polling station there in Los Angeles over the weekend. What was the mood like?
Well, there was a remarkable turnout on Friday and Saturday. People were overwhelmed with exuberation and jubilation and joy and happiness. And many group of people were dancing and clapping and wearing their, you know, national costumes. So it was a remarkable display of harmony and unity among the Iraqis on the West Coast.
You yourself were not able to vote, though.
Yes, unfortunately, I was not able to vote because during the registration for the voting, I was in the pilgrimage in Mecca, and I tried when I came back here to convince the committee here to extend the registration, but they declined. But I think my voice is more important than my vote. I was there encouraging people and showing my solidarity and support to those who were there and to our fellow Iraqis inside Iraq.
It was members of your family were there to vote.
Yes, my wife was there to vote. My brothers who did not join us in the pilgrimage were here to vote. I also took my children with me. They wished that they were 18 and they were able to vote. Although we could not vote, but we opted to put our fingers in the ink, special ink, to show our unity and our sympathy with our fellow Iraqis. So at least we could color our fingers, and that was something very good.
As you talk to people in the community, and I know you do this all the time, what do they say they want to see happen next in Iraq?
Of course, they believe that this is the beginning of a free Iraq. This is the very first step. And also they hope that occupation will come to an end after having a sovereign Iraqi government. They understand that this new political body, which is emerging soon, is going to draft the new constitution of Iraq. They hope that this constitution will bring harmony, stability, justice to the Iraqis. Iraqis suffered for a long, long time, and they believe that now it's time to turn the page and begin a new Iraq, which has dignity and respect for all Iraqis, regardless of their ethnicities and their religious background.
I know you speak often as well with members of your family in Najaf and Karbala. How are they responding to what happened yesterday?
Yes, we were in touch with them, and they went in good numbers. I think the turnout, especially in southern Iraq, was a very high percentage. They also went for the polling stations. They were happy about that. It was a day of celebration inside Iraq, a day of festivities. You know, people, especially the new generation, could not believe that a day will come and that they will be free voting for whoever think is right to vote for. It's the end of the a long period of suffering under the regime of Saddam Hussein. And I think it was not only a day of triumph and victory for Iraqis, but it was a day of defeat and disgrace for and humiliation for the terrorists, for Saddam Hussein, for the orphans of the Ba'athist regime.
Imam, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you, Neil.
Imam Syed Mustafa Al-Kazwini, Imam at the Islamic Education Center of Orange County, California, joined us from his home in Los Angeles. When we come back from a break, we'll talk more about what Sunday's elections mean for Iraq's future, and we'll take more of your calls. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about Iraq's elections yesterday, and joining us now are two people who spent considerable time working and teaching in Iraq. Larry Diamond was an advisor to Paul Bremer and the former Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, and he joins us now from the studios on the Stanford campus there in California. Nice to have you back on the program, Larry.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Also with us is Michael Rubin, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, also an advisor to Paul Bremer and the CPA in Baghdad, just returned from another more recent visit to Iraq. And Michael Rubin is with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to ask you both your reaction to yesterday's election and the relative lack of violence that occurred. Larry Diamond, why don't you go first?
Exhilarating. I think I was on a show with Michael in the last 2 days, and my guess is his reaction will be similar, if not even more effusive. It's a huge defeat for the terrorists and the insurgents, and most of all, it's a victory for the Iraqi people and a demonstration of the fact that you don't need to have a lot of democratic experience to begin making a democracy.
Michael?
I would agree. It was a day of firsts. And this, when I was attending election events at the beginning of this month, one Iraqi pointed out that it was the first time he had ever witnessed a campaign not only in Iraq, but a campaign in Arabic. Likewise, whatever government results is going to be a coalition government in a region that's dominated by kings, strongmen, and single parties. It teaches compromise. And then the greatest irony, perhaps, was in Syria, where the Iraqi expatriate community lined up to vote in Syria in the first free elections ever in Syria, and ironically, Syrians couldn't take part.
Larry Diamond, you were on the show a couple of weeks ago, and at the time you were urging the possibility of a delay to bring more Sunnis on board to encourage their participation in this election. Again, we don't have turnout numbers or official turnout numbers yet, but every indication is that turnout was lower, if not extremely low, in many Sunni areas.
Well, you have what I anticipated, which is an enormously high turnout, both in the Kurdish north and in the Shiite south, which accounts for a majority of the entire population, and a pretty low turnout in some Sunni sections of the country, which will leave these Sunni sections underrepresented because of the nature of the electoral system. Now, there are various ways of compensating for this. I think the best way would have been to change the electoral system and bring them in from the very beginning into the parliament. But the new coalition government could take initiatives to have a very broad-based constitutional drafting committee, to have a very broad-based cabinet, and I think that if they would also seek a national roundtable dialogue to widen the underlying political consensus in the country, all of this could be very conducive to stabilizing the new political order and possibly reducing the violence.
Michael, would you agree that the Iraqis have to find a way to bring the Sunnis into the process?
Not only do they have to, they already are. I mean, one out of every seven candidates on the Sistani-endorsed Shia list is actually Sunni. And while I would hope that many more Sunnis would vote, especially when the constitution goes to a referendum in December, the fact of the matter is, if Sunnis have low participation, that no more makes this election illegitimate than a white boycott would in South Africa.
Well, let's get some callers on the line. Again, our number 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We'll begin with Judd, who's calling from Pocatello, Idaho.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for you and your panelists, now that we've had these free elections, what kind of political structure how is the political structure going to be changing, both within Iraq and also on an international front with other countries, both within and outside of the coalition?
Well, Judd, with the proviso... all right, thanks for the call, Judd, and we have to begin with accepting that we don't know what the results are, but Larry Diamond, some structures will change.
Well, yeah, you're going to have an elected government for the first time, freely elected government in at least half a century. It's useful to remind ourselves what's going to happen. The new parliament will convene probably in the second half of February. It will, first of all, organize itself and choose a speaker of the National Assembly. This will be a very important body, someone who will steer the consensus-building process. Then it will elect a three-member presidency council. And already there, we might be able to see coalition formation in terms of the breadth of that council. Then it will choose a prime minister for the country who will probably already have majority support of a coalition that will have been cobbled together in the country, and that prime minister will choose a cabinet and it will have to get majority approval. Then the parliament will begin writing a constitution and probably appoint a technical constitutional drafting committee. All of these will be, as Michael said, arenas for consensus formation. The problem, however, and one slight difference I have with Michael, is that it's not just a question of whether there are Sunnis in these bodies. It's a question of which Sunnis and whether they are seen by communities that feel aggrieved to be representative of them.
And, Michael, obviously the insurgency is not going to go away. We're just seeing videotape today of what looks like a shootdown of that British Hercules yesterday, the C-130 that crashed, killing 10 British soldiers or British troops on board. And an insurgent group is taking responsibility for that. Yet this has to be seen as a tremendous blow to the insurgents.
I agree with you. I mean, in military history, insurgencies tend to last an average of 10 years. It's not going away anytime soon, but the best way to defeat the insurgency is to pick a program, which we did, and the Iraqis did, and move forward with it and not deviate from it. So very much I do think that we will make progress, and frankly, as long as the Iraqis are moving forward with a much more legitimate process rather than an appointed government, they're on the right step to eventually defeating the insurgency.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Pete calling from Sonoma, California.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment regarding yesterday's elections. I feel almost a sense of validation. I'm a first Gulf War veteran, and I feel like, you know, what I did over there, what was done over there to begin with when we initially started our occupation of that area, you know, I feel validated by having participated in that activity. But I think that there's a
I applaud the Iraqi people for having, in spite of the threat of attacks that were made, that they still went out and did what they did. I feel like they stood alongside of the coalition forces who are in their country at this time. You know, they stood right beside the Marines and the Army and everybody that's over there fighting for them, just by having stood in line, in spite of the attack threats.
Pete, thank you very much. Very interesting
call.
Thank you,
guys.
Preach. Should we see this vote yesterday, just following on from Pete's call, but should we see this vote yesterday as Iraqis in any sense voting to endorse American policy? Michael?
No, I mean, this election was about Iraqi policy. When you looked at the campaign slogans, whether it was Ayad Alawi, the interim prime minister's Iraqi list, or whether it was this United Iraqi Alliance, the so-called Sistani-endorsed list, the major campaign issue was security, not the presence or not of American forces. Most Iraqis would say that they want to eventually see the American forces leave. However, they don't want to see them leave right away, because that would create a dangerous security vacuum. When I talk to the Iraqis about American policy, what they say is they want to regularize the American presence. They want a status of a forces agreement, sort of like what we have in Turkey, Italy, Japan, Korea, wherever we station troops. And they also want respect. I mean, I had written a piece recently where I'd gone to the convention center inside the Green Zone, and it has a huge Iraqi flag flying over it, but it had a no-smoking regulation inside. This is an Iraqi building. Half the population smokes, but we were imposing a rule for American social mores upon them. And even though I don't smoke, that sort of thing needs to stop.
Let's get another caller in. This is Jake, who's with us from Chubbuck, Idaho.
Howdy. Hey, my question is, I'm one of the people who've been fairly critical, probably pretty quick to point out the errors in judgment as I've seen them in the Bush administration and how they've handled the war there in Iraq and the occupation. But I'm wondering now, in light of the election, if I might not be justified in feeling optimistic and hopeful about, despite all our errors, if we are not maybe doing something to create a real democracy in the Middle East. Does the facts on the ground, do they support that type of optimism and hopefulness? That's my question, I should say.
Larry Diamond, you shared some of Jake's doubts. You're apparently feeling pretty good today.
I'm feeling pretty good at what the Iraqis have done. I'm still worried on a number of fronts, and I think that the biggest congratulations goes to the Iraqis. We made, in my opinion, a lot of mistakes along the way, although I do really take my hat off to the American Armed Forces and the United Nations in assisting the Iraqi Independent Electoral Commission, because logistically this went much better than I expected and that many people had expected. I mean, they brought off a logistically enormously difficult and challenging election. I think we've got to be a little bit sober here, Neil. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of difficulties along the way in the next few months. We don't even know what the results are yet. We don't know how successful the coalition formation will be. And there's going to be intense controversy when they get to issues of the role of religion in public life, the degree of federalism or not, all of the controversies that surrounded the making of the interim constitution, which were suppressed at the end, largely because it was just a temporary document and there was a deadline and the process needed to go forward. Those controversies are going to resurface, and they will certainly occasion very, very intense political debate in Iraq. That could be a good thing if the final result of that is compromise.
Jake, you were trying to get in there? I'm sorry?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think what might have happened for people here in this country, when we've finally seen the Iraqi people, like the public at large, seem to stand up for themselves and take an active hand in controlling their own destiny, I think what might have happened in the public eyes, we might have suddenly realized that they're human in an intimate way that hadn't occurred to us yet. And I think instead of them being just a debatable political issue here in our country, I think we might have suddenly realized, well, these are human beings who are actually striving to control their own future and their own civil rights in a way that might have the effect of throwing a lot more public support behind the occupation efforts. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'll take your comments off the line.
Jacob, thanks very much for the phone call. Mike, did you want to respond to that?
I would agree with that. Sometimes there seems to be an almost cartoonish perspective that the only legitimate Sunni is wielding a grenade and the only legitimate Shia has a turban on. But Iraq is a very complex society, a very politically mature society, and consistently they, instead of voicing maximalist demands, their intention is to compromise. I suspect that the final constitution will be a compromise, ideal to none, but fair to all.
We're talking about yesterday's elections in Iraq. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. One of the Iraqi cities where jubilation was high yesterday was the holy Shiite city of Najaf, located south of Baghdad. Washington Post foreign reporter Douglas Strzok was there to report on the day's events. He has since returned to Baghdad and joins us from the capital city. Thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Tell us what it was like yesterday in Najaf.
Najaf was a very optimistic place and a very effective place to be in. There was a great goodwill that was spread throughout this old and fairly battered city. As you'll recall, just 5 months ago, there was fierce fighting in Najaf between American forces and the Mahdi army. So it was really quite impressive to see a day in which not only people were going to the polls eagerly and enthusiastically, but they were quite comfortable with what American troops they had seen in the city in the days before. Actually, on election day, no American troops even left their base. They just left the security to the Iraqis. There was just a feeling of goodwill. There was a feeling of enthusiasm. There was a feeling of eagerness. You saw it in other places of the country, but it was particularly true in Najaf, where the Shia had for so long been oppressed and tortured and killed by Saddam Hussein and his regime. They were there basically to get rid of the past.
The Shias went to the ballot box yesterday in the expectation that, they're believed to be 60% of the population, that the government that will emerge will be majority Shia. What did people there in Najaf tell you yesterday about governing with other peoples in Iraq, the Sunnis, the Kurds?
I think the voters that I talked to, as well as the officials and as well as the clerics that I talked to, are very conscious of the fact that Iraq is a country that has to include all three major ethnic groups, the Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds, and they realize that this cannot be a time for revenge if the Shia become the dominant party in Iraq. As a practical political matter, they are probably not going to have a majority in the next National Assembly anyhow. There will have to be coalitions formed. They will have to work with all of the players. So even the people on the street that I talked to said, yes, we're not going to vote only so that the Shia can come to power. We're going to vote for Iraq. We're going to vote as nationalists. We're going to vote for a country that we can work together in and try to form one nation.
As you talk to people in Najaf today after the election, I wonder, did you get a sense of that something important had changed yesterday?
I think so. It's not clear whether that important thing is entirely related to the future or to the past. What I really felt is that people had, with their vote, made an affirmative act that got rid of the past for them. You have to remember that the Shia were, for so many years, thrown into prison by the Saddam Hussein regime. They were impoverished. They were tortured. And now they were coming to finally bury that grief, to sort of put a rest to the grief by putting a ballot in the ballot box.
Douglas Strzok, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Douglas Strzok is a foreign reporter for The Washington Post and joined us from his office in Baghdad. When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue talking about the elections yesterday and continue taking more of your calls. Our number is 800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Michael Rubin, a political advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority, as was Larry Diamond, our other guest. They both have different views running up to the election, and both seem to be taking heart at what happened yesterday, though both point out there will be many hurdles yet to come, not the least of which is the opposition of the insurgents in Iraq. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now from a part of Iraq where turnout was relatively low, at least in places, is Steve Fainaru. And Steve, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Neil, thanks.
Now, you were up in Mosul in the northern part of Iraq where insurgents were at least somewhat successful in keeping turnout relatively low.
Right. Well, especially in the sector of the city that I was in the southeast part of Mosul, in the neighborhoods of Al-Wada and Palestine, and in I went to four polling places in that sector, and I saw a total of four voters all day. All of them were women, three in one polling place and one in another. And in each case, when you talk to people around the polling places, all had said that they had hoped to vote, but they were simply too frightened to go inside. In one case, there were literally a cluster of men about 25 feet from the entrance to the polling site, but they, all of them said that they wanted to vote, but they were too scared.
Were they aware of what was going on elsewhere in Iraq, that so many people were coming out to vote?
I'm not sure they were. It was sort of, at that point, well, particularly in the morning, you know, it was sort of hard to tell what was going on in the rest of Iraq and the rest of the city, because there were parts of Mosul that were where the turnout was actually quite strong. I don't think that they did. I think if you watch television as the day went on, the turnout became stronger. I think this was particularly true in Baghdad, that people began to see that the attacks were not quite as ferocious as people had anticipated, and that more and more people were going to the polls, and that sort of generated momentum. I never saw that. I never saw it all day long. But then once I had sort of finished at the end of my day, I started to talk to other people who had been out, and I heard anecdotally that sort of the same thing occurred in Mosul. But where I was, you didn't see it.
Mm-hmm. Those few who did vote, what did they tell you?
I only talked to one. The other three wouldn't talk to me. But the one person was a 70-year-old woman who said she wasn't afraid of anyone, and she was voting for Alawi because he'd given her a pension. So she walked in with her 9-year-old granddaughter, and she was treated like a celebrity at the polling site. All the election workers crowded around her and then crowded into the cardboard voting booth with her to help her cast her ballot for Alawi, and then helped her walk over to put her ballot in the plastic box, and then they got her a chair so that she could then sit down and be interviewed by me.
Well, I'm glad she decided to talk to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Steve Fainaru of the Washington Post joining us from the Iraqi city of Mosul. Anyway, let's continue with our guests. Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute, former advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority. Also, former CPA advisor Larry Diamond, now a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Stacy. Stacy's calling from Tonopah, Nevada.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I thought you'd never get to my call.
Oh, well, sometimes patience is rewarded.
Yeah. I'm relating to the British and American presence. You know, I believe that as long as there's a foreign presence in Iraq, the violence will continue. It's the turnout, the voter turnout was a great victory for Iraqis. It has nothing to do with America, because America's presence going there has been to wreak havoc and also destruction upon the Iraqi people, left and right, right and left. And this is the kind of thing, you know, that the foreign presence, they're employing the use of divide and conquer, and it's not serving any constructive purpose.
Some might point out, Stacey, there would not have been a vote yesterday without the presence of American and British troops.
I can't agree with that, because the determination and the resolve of the Iraqi people would have come to fore eventually. Because this is something that I believe was a manifest destiny in the final analysis.
Larry Diamond, let's get. I wanted to get your reaction. We asked Michael earlier whether he thought this was in any way the vote yesterday was in any way an endorsement of American policies. Get your reaction on that.
Well, first of all, let's be intellectually honest. If there had not been an American and British invasion, Saddam Hussein would still be in power, and Iraqis would not be voting in a multi-party election today. That's just obvious. Second of all, I think Iraqis feel, and Michael has talked about this, ambivalent about the United States. On the one hand, I think there still is a certain gratitude for toppling Saddam. In the Kurdish North, certainly, there's a gratitude for much of what the United States has done. But there's a recognition, I think, around the country that if American troops were to simply withdraw now, the country could slip back into a much worse chaos and possibly a warlord-style civil war. But there is a desire to get back their country fully and to have the Americans withdraw as soon as possible. So it's a mixture of feelings. This is a very proud nationalistic country. They do not want to be under international military occupation, I think, at all, and certainly not for very much longer. There will be pressure to try and develop some sort of, if not explicit timetable, I'd say at least goal for a phased American withdrawal.
Stacey, thanks very much for the phone call.
Yeah. Okay, well, the motivation, it just wasn't honest, you know, to invade in the first place. You know, that's why I part company with the gentleman's assessment of the situation.
Okay, Stacey.
But thank you.
Appreciate it.
She should know, by the way, that I opposed going to war.
Let's get another caller in. This is Todd, and Todd's calling from Peachtree City, Georgia.
Yes, sir. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, now that the Iraqis have been able to vote, and once they draft their constitution, is that constitution going to be subject to the Bush administration's approval, or are they going to be able to just make the constitution that they want to have?
Michael Rubin, how much is the next constitution going to owe to the one, the interim constitution?
Well, the Iraqis are going to write their own constitution. Many Iraqis, when I would speak to Sunni Arabs from Mosul, when I would speak to Shia or Kurds, suspected that the compromises they made on the transitional administrative law, this so-called interim constitution, would come into play again. That said, the Bush administration doesn't have veto. No one has veto power over whatever constitution the Iraqis come up with, except for the Iraqi people. There's going to be a referendum, and if the Iraqi people vote no, or if the majority in three governorates vote no, there's a new election, and they go back to the drawing board.
A new election for people in office, or a new election for a drafting of a new constitution?
A new election to create a new transitional legislature to draft a new constitution.
Larry Diamond, let me ask you, we had John Lee Anderson on from the New Yorker magazine last week, and he was talking about some sort of unstated, yes, of course, the United States in a formal way has no role in the constitutional process in Iraq, no role in the formation of the new government in Iraq, but that there are unstated circumstances that the United States has made it clear that it would like to see.
First of all, the United States is involved already in the negotiations over the new government, so this may be informal, but it's happening. There is a very significant American political shadow that is cast over this whole process. But Michael is certainly right. The Iraqis will make this constitution, and I think once Iraq has an elected government, that has resulted from a free vote of the Iraqi people and then an intense coalition-making process in the parliament. I think American leverage over this situation is going to gradually decline, they're not going to welcome American interference in the constitution-making process at all, I think. They're fully capable of doing it themselves. If I could just correct one thing. In the referendum, the constitution can only be vetoed by three provinces if each of them casts at least a two-thirds negative vote against it. It can't simply be a majority vote.
We thank you for the clarification. We won't accept it as a correction, but an enhancement of our previous understanding. Larry Diamond, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure.
Larry Diamond was an advisor to the former U.S. Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford, and he joined us from the studios on the Stanford campus. Michael Rubin was also an advisor to the CPA. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, just back from Iraq a couple of weeks. And as you came out of Iraq, just briefly, was the transition out of Iraq still as difficult as it was last year?
Every time I go out of Iraq, I go out through a different border. Every time I leave Iraq, there's a little bit more formality, a little bit more professionalism. This time I left from the Baghdad airport, there were visa controls, there was airport tax collection. It is a good sign that Iraq is starting to normalize a bit.
Well, Michael Rubin, thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Again, Michael Rubin of the American Enterprise Institute. By the way, tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, we'll be talking about the future of the American role in Iraq, a different subject than what had happened yesterday, so join us at that time. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.